Was Canada's involvement in the major conflicts of the 20th century truly about a valiant fight for freedom and democracy, as Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper has maintained in numerous public speeches? Who were the major players driving Canada and other countries into war? What were the political and economic forces that triggered and maintained World War I? How has that conflict shaped the world we live in today, and what lessons can be learned from that tragic conflict? On the occasion of Remembrance Week, and on the year marking the 100th anniversary of the start of World War I, the Global Research News Hour attempts to shatter some of the myths surrounding the past conflicts in which Canada has become engaged with the help of activist and author Eve Engler, and with historian and author Jacques Powells. On today's program, Lest We Forget, Rethinking the War to End All Wars. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 7th, 2014. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. You can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. So, one of the two first international monitors on site saw conclusive evidence that the Malaysian plane had been hit by very, very strong machine gun fire, not by ground-based missile fire. Peter Hisenko's reconstruction of the downing of that airliner was here being essentially confirmed on site by one of the two first OSCE international monitors to arrive on site while the wreckage was still smoldering. Unlike a black box interpretation analysis long afterward by the Russian government, or by the British government, or by the Ukrainian government, each of which governments has a horse in this race, this testimony from Bosyrkiu is raw, independent, and comes from one of the two earliest witnesses to the physical evidence. That's powerfully authoritative testimony, and it happens to confirm pilot Peter Hisenko's theory of what happened. Bosyrkiu arrived there fast because he negotiated with the locals for the rest of the OSCE team, who were organizing to come later. Bosyrko speaks the local languages there, Ukrainian and Russian. That's from the article, "Evidence is now conclusive. Two Ukrainian government fighter jets shot down Malaysian Airlines MH17. It was not a Buk surface-to-air missile." By Eric Zeus, posted November 5th. The cause of the shooting down of Malaysian passenger plane MH17 on July 17th, while that plane was flying over the conflict zone during Ukraine's civil war, is becoming clearer and clearer, despite the rigorous continuing attempts by Western news media to cover it up and to hide from the public the evidence that clearly shows what brought down this airliner. The BBC had previously posted to their website on 23 July 2014, just 6 days after the event itself, a news report in Russian via their Russian service about the downing, but they quickly removed it without explanation. Fortunately, however, some Russian speakers had managed to download it before it was yanked, and one of those downloads is still up at YouTube, having been posted there on July 28th, with English subscripts and with the headline, "Ukraine Eyewitness Confirm Military Jet Flew Besides MH17 Airliner, BBC Censors Video, 25 July 2014. So this valuable eyewitness testimony to the event is available despite Western news media or propaganda media, and the reason for the news suppression is clear from anyone who views that BBC report, which presents several eyewitnesses, all of whom were interviewed separately as individuals, not as a group, and yet all of whose testimonies report having observed the very same basic narrative of at least one military jet rising toward the airliner just before it came down. In other words, BBC had yanked this piece because it didn't confirm the West's storyline, which says that Ukrainian pro-Russian separatists fired a Buk ground-based missile at the airliner, thinking that the civilian plane was a Ukrainian government warplane about to bomb them and their families. That's from the article, Western News Suppression About the Downing of MH17 Malaysian Jet by Eric Zeus, posted November 6th. Today, an estimated 55% of U.S. oil production and all the production increase of the past several years comes from fracking for shale oil. With financing cut off because of economic risk amid falling oil prices, shale oil drillers will be forced to halt new drilling that is needed merely to maintain a steady oil output. The aggressive U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, its war against Syria's al-Assad regime, its hardball oil sanctions against Iran, its sanctions against Russian oil projects, its cynical toleration of ISIS in Iraqi oil regions, its refusal to intervene to stabilize the Libyan oil economy, but instead to tolerate disorder, are all premised on a cocky view in Washington that the USA is once again the king of oil in the world and can afford to play high-risk oil geopolitics. The official government agency responsible for advising the CIA, Department of Defense, State Department, and White House on energy, the U.S. Department of Energy, has issued projections of U.S. shale oil growth based on myths and lies. That has led the Obama White House to launch oil wars based on those same myths and lies about the rosy prospects of shale oil. That comes from the article, The Collapse of Oil Prices, Has Washington Just Shot Itself in the Oily Foot? By F. William Engdahl, posted November 6th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. Briefly, the Navy is proposing to turn a large part of Washington's magnificent Olympic Peninsula, as well as a portion of northeastern Washington, into electronic warfare training ranges. A giant antenna resembling a house-sized golf ball will be installed at the naval station at Moclips, just outside the Quino Indian Reservation on the Olympic Peninsula. According to the data in the environmental assessment, I calculate that it will have an effective power of 5 million watts. Needless to say, the peace of the Olympic Peninsula will be destroyed forever. The radiation in both locations will impact predominantly Native Americans. That is from the article, Electromagnetic Warfare Training Range to be Established in Washington State's Olympic Peninsula, by Arthur Furstenberg, posted November 5th, originally appearing at TakeBackYourPower.net. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. In Canada, the annual Memorial Day known as Remembrance Day was conceived principally as an occasion to reflect on the sacrifices of soldiers who lost their lives while serving in military conflicts. It is commemorated on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, coinciding with the signing of the armistice in 1918, which marked the official end of World War I. Remembrance Day typically honors the service of military personnel in the 20th century conflicts in which Canada has participated. But what exactly was the role of Canada in those conflicts, and what does her military policy say about the values that Canada espouses? To discuss this, we're joined by Yves Engler. He is an activist and author of numerous books on Canadian foreign policy, including The Black Book on Canadian Foreign Policy, Canada and Israel Building Apartheid, and his latest, The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy. Thanks once again for joining us, Yves Engler.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, maybe we should go back to the First World War. Based on the research that you've done, what would you say was Canada's principal interest in becoming involved in that conflict?
Supporting the British Empire, mm-hmm. Very clearly, and This was the high time of imperialism, European imperialism across the globe, particularly in Africa, and there was competition from were between the dominant imperial powers, Britain and France, and the up-and-coming imperial power, Germany, and it led to a major conflict where I think 600,000 Canadians end up fighting. Huge numbers of them end up dying and being injured, and probably almost everyone who went was damaged in one way or another, psychologically or physically. So it took a huge toll on the Canadians who went to fight, but it also took a huge toll on people from other countries. And I'm currently doing a book about Canada's role in Africa, and it was actually a Canadian who headed up the British. He was actually in charge of British and French troops in West Africa that conquered the Cameroons from Germany. So basically, they used World War I as a sort of pretext to capture more of West Africa. Both France and England did that, and it was a Canadian who was in charge of that, and it was Canadians who fought a number of different places in Africa during World War I. So it was there was no doubt that people, and many of them, some of them were at least, were conscripted, who went to go fight in World War I. But we have to also remember, to a large extent, in the case of World War I, most of it, early on at least, was voluntary, so people choosing to fight, and people were caught up by the glory of the empire and the glory of fighting for Britain's empire, and that's the main I think that's the main story of World War I. Today it's gotten to the point of you'll hear things like Stephen Harper and others who talk about World War I as a fight against fascism or a fight against totalitarianism, or they sort of try to obscure what World War, they sort of bring World War I and World War II sort of together in some way. But it was very clearly a completely destructive, useless war, where at one point there was over a year where they didn't move more than like to 10 kilometers in France, where tens, hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered over minuscule pieces of land, and the Canadian elite and the whole Canadian political culture very much supported this brutal inter-imperial conflict.
I'm curious about the role at home, because I know that in Quebec there was resistance to essentially the British Empire, when Quebecers don't necessarily identify themselves as part and parcel of that empire. Canada is an independent country. What was the nature of the conversation during the war?
Well, it was incredible jingoism in most parts of the country in terms of favoring the war. Obviously, in Quebec, that was different. There was instances actually in Quebec. There was obviously lots of opposition to the war and opposition to conscription. But there was at times McGill students who went over to the French universities and attacked the French universities, for being pacifistic or whatever. So sort of fascistic thugs, if you like, Anglophone thugs who were attacking perceived or actual anti-war kind of sentiment. You've got to remember that someone like Ginger Goodwin, out on the labor leader out on the West Coast, was not 100% confirmed, but most of the historical evidence suggests was killed by police agents for his opposition to the war. So it was a brutal the state repression in terms of those who dissented was quite extreme. So it's kind of particularly ironic to hear Harper talk about World War I is about fighting against totalitarianism, when in fact, if anything, within Canada at least, World War I really heightened sort of totalitarian kind of instincts of of the government. So I mean, that's, you know, as in recent weeks and months, we've seen with what's happened in Ottawa, and the killing of the soldier in just outside of Montreal. There's been a growth of sort of jingoistic kind of rally behind the flag type of sentiment, but we're talking about a whole different scale during World War One of just, you know, the extremeness of this was infinitely greater today. So in some ways we should be, you know, while there's still some major issues on the front of nationalistic jingoism and war today, in many ways it's less extreme than it was historically, and I think that's in part because of the anti-war movements, tracing right back to World War One. And one other thing about World War One we have to remember also is that Canada sent troops to try to crush the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Very very hostile act to Russia, and hard to argue that it was, and it was very much a sideshow to World War One. And even once World War One ended, they initially claimed they were sending the troops to get Russia to re-enter the war, which was never true. But even after World War One had ended, the troops stayed for months. So really completely showing that pretext was nonsense. There was also at the same time there were Canadians who refused to fight, who were in the army, who refused to go to Russia to participate in undermining the attempts to change social conditions in Russia at that time. So there was incredible jingoism, incredible warmongering, but there was also signs of dissent and people refusing to follow orders that were leading to all kinds of destruction.
Now, what about World War II? Because that's seen as a more acceptable war. I mean, we fighting against the forces of fascism, Hitler, and of course, Italy. There was Mussolini and so on. So, whether or not it was a good thing or a bad thing, what was Canada's motivation in participating in that war?
I mean, it's clear that after the fact, undermining and destroying Hitler and Nazism was a positive thing. Almost no one would argue, I think, against that. I would hope. Whether that was the initial motivation or how the Canadian motivation was sort of formed, was Canada trying to fight anti-Semitism? Was Canada trying to fight fascism? No. That was not the primary motivation of Canadian policymakers, and the primary motivation, as one on World War II puts it very clearly, it was to support the British Empire, just like it was in World War One. The British Empire was challenged by Nazi expansionism, while the Nazis were focusing their ire against the Soviets. There was quite a bit of support for Hitler. Prime Minister Mackenzie King visits Berlin and Germany in the mid-1937, not very long before the war breaks out, and he is very clear in his diary. He's quite anti-Semitic, and very clear in his diary that he has all kinds of support for Hitler. He personally has, a great deal of sympathy for Hitler. And I can't remember the exact quotes, but how Hitler's role in lifting up the German peoples and stuff like that. Very, no ambiguity in terms of expressing sympathy for Hitler. So it, after the fact, it has been there's been an attempt to portray it as some sort of fight against the evils of Nazism in terms of anti-Semitism and in terms of the fascistic element of the system, but there was actually a great deal of sympathy for those elements in Canada, and again know, doing this, currently doing this, this book on Canada's role in Africa, there's throughout World War II, there's a complete acceptance by Canadian officials of British and French colonial rule in Africa, and there's Canadians who will fight, particularly in Northern Africa. And you know, while they would say they were fighting to you know, undermine Nazism or undermine the Italian-German, you know, as part of that war, at the same time, they were, you know, propping up British-French colonial rule. So from the perspective of Africans, for instance, you know, was World War II a good thing, or you know, how does Canada's role in the war, how you know, how do you look at it from their perspective? So you know, clearly World War II, after the fact, the destruction of Nazism, positive. I don't think anyone or very few people would argue with that. Mm. Some of the ways the war was fought in terms of destroying German cities, that really it was civilians that were being targeted. I think there's some major questions there about, you know, major war crimes and stuff like that. But yeah, the you know, the effect of World War II was, you know, ending the Nazism, at least, was obviously a very good thing.
Just to help secure that point, in just a few years previous, there was the Spanish Civil War, in which many Canadians tried to organize in support of the government against a fascist takeover. And just the way the Canadian government responded to you know, Canadians whose sympathies were with the democratically elected government is quite telling about their attitudes towards the fight against fascism.
Yeah, no, that is an incredibly important part of the lead up, and that the response of Ottawa and London and others very much emboldened Mussolini and Hitler, because they poured huge amounts of weaponry into backing the Franco's fascist forces, and to a large extent, the Canadian political elite went along with that. They brought in the War Measures, not the War Measures Act, the Foreign Enlistment Act, to block, to make it illegal for Canadians to go fight on behalf of the democratic forces in Spain. That's an act that's still on the books until today, but very selectively applied. So it's sort of, you know, focused on if you go fight for if you join to the tens of thousands of Canadians who joined American military to fight in Vietnam. That of course was not brought forward, but it was, you know, used to stop Canadians in 1936. So that's an important part of the lead up to World War II, and a, you know, sort of proof of how Ottawa was sympathetic to the British and to the Nazis and not antagonistic to Italian and German expansionism, so long as it was focused on undermining democratic and leftward forces. And to some extent, the same is true with regards to Italy's invasion of Ethiopia in 1936, which was clearly against the League of Nations, clearly illegal. There was against the agreements that had been signed between Italy and Ethiopia going back a number of years, and it was a horrible slaughter of Ethiopians by the Italians. And there was a push at the League of Nations. There was actually a Canadian who was part of a commission the League of Nations created to bring in sanctions, particularly oil and coal sanctions against Italy. And even though it was actually a Canadian who was part of the one drafting this proposal, the Canadian government distanced itself from the proposal, and there was even actually some British support, but Canadian officials didn't want to move down that path of really sanctioning Italy, which again emboldened the fascistic forces and you know, very much reinforced European colonialism in Africa. So if you look at the history leading up to World War II, it's very clear that, again, the motivation was not let's fight anti-Semitism, let's fight fascism. In fact, in two major instances, they had greatly, i.e. Spain, and Ethiopia, they had greatly enabled, Canada had greatly enabled the fascistic forces against a lot of opinion. In the case of, in the case of Spain, there was obviously many Canadians who risked their life to go fight for democratic forces. But also in the case of, to a much lesser extent, but in the case of Ethiopia, there was, you know, the CCF was pushing for the oil sanctions proposal in the House of Commons, and the government of the day was not not having any of it. So so yes, clearly the history in the lead up to World War II shows that that the motivation was not what it's sort of being portrayed as today.
Now, Eve, we're on the eve of Remembrance Day, and of course, this is an occasion where, at least in the bygone era, I remember the sentiments, never again, and lest we forget. If we were really true to those imperatives, what would you argue that ordinary citizens who really would like to see an end to war and injustice, what should they be doing, you know, perhaps as an alternative to the traditional wearing of the poppy and attending Remembrance Day ceremonies? What do we need to do as citizens to secure a better world?
Well, I think that, I mean, the first thing, there is a campaign, there is the White Poppy campaign, and it basically says we should be recognizing all victims of war, not just you know, the Canadians who fought and died, but also the Koreans who were killed in large numbers by Canadian forces in Korea in between 1950 and 1953, the Afghans who've been killed by Canadian and Western forces over the past decade or so. So to take a more holistic to take when you start recognizing the victims on you know, everywhere, not just the Canadian soldiers, it softens the potential for the sort of jingoism that comes along with the poppy and Remembrance Day. Obviously, the Canadian soldiers who have been hurt and maimed in wars, there should be some degree of you know, remembrance for what's happened to them, but when it becomes clearly part of this sort of jingoism of our side being hurt, and the implication there is that that we're righteous and moral, and basically it gives the political leaders of the day the sort of ideological cover to continue with more wars. We're seeing that right now, where the reaction of Ottawa to 20 years of Iraq being bombed and occupied and having all kinds of they're having their politics be controlled and influenced and by Washington or London, the reaction to the Canadian political elite to recent developments in Iraq is to continue that trajectory of bombing and intervention and which, you know, I think to a large extent is what's brought the problems in Iraq that exist today, the rise of ISIS to Islamic State to where it is. So the option of more bombing is not the right option. So I think that, you know, a simple thing is to wear the white poppy. Here in Montreal, Cheka Laguerre is actually organizing a little sort of action on Remembrance Day in terms of the white poppy campaign and drawing attention to the ongoing or the just started Canadian war in Iraq. So I think that those kind of initiatives are where people who are peace minded and who want to see an end to the destruction of war and the horrors of war for everyone. I think that's some of that where people should focus their energies on.
Eve Engler, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Eve Engler is an activist and the author of a number of critiques of Canadian foreign policy, including the Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy, Canada and Israel Building Apartheid, and his latest, The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the start of the First World War. World War I was the war that was supposed to end all wars. Unfortunately, that hasn't been the case. But what exactly was World War I all about? What triggered it? And what were the forces that conspired to generate it? I'm joined right now by Jacques Pauwels. He is the author of The Myth of the Good War, America in the Second World War, and Beneath the Dust of Time, A History of the Names of Peoples and Places, and of an upcoming book dealing precisely with World War I. Jacques Pauwels, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure being here.
Was World War I, in some sense, an inevitable outcome from the growth of the Industrial Revolution, or was it just some sort of a strange historical idiosyncrasy that just got out of hand?
Well, Michael, I am not one who subscribes to the idea that the First World War broke out unexpectedly and against the will of most people, certainly not against the will of our leaders, as it's sometimes mentioned. Some authors speak of how our leaders sort of sleepwalked into the war. I don't believe that. Some people, some historians say that the war was a collective accident of history. You might say a rote accident of history. Others called it the great collective stupidity, which means that it's overall to blame for whatever reason. I don't see that. I think the war was not an accident. I think it was in the air for a long time. I think the history of Europe in the 19th century and in the early 20th century was basically leading towards war for a number of reasons. In my book on the First World War, I actually pay a lot of attention to the 19th century because in many ways the First World War was the product of that long 19th century. And it was also, of course, the mother, you might say, the First World War was also the mother of the shorter 20th century. But let's look for a moment at how the 19th century produced the Great War, the First World War. The 19th century was a century of revolutions and wars, wars and revolutions, starting with the French Revolution. The 19th century has often been described as the long 19th century. It started in some ways with the French Revolution of 1789, which was followed by wars, including the Napoleonic Wars. Then there were revolutions in 1830 and 1848, which also basically led to the wars with the Russian armies occupying Poland and moving into Budapest and you name it. Then the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71 led to the Paris Commune, a pretty nasty little revolution, you could call it. And, of course, in 1905, Russia went to war with Japan, and that produced a revolution in Russia. And then you have the First World War, and that's a big war that produces a revolution in Russia again. So there is a dialectic here between war and revolution, where the one sort of causes the other one and vice versa. And I think we cannot look at World War I without looking at it in this context. It was a war that was also linked up with the idea of revolution. And here I should say right away that the leaders of Western European countries and also Central European countries, like Germany and, in fact, of Eastern European countries like Russia, the leaders of these countries, the French, the British, the Germans, and the Russians, they really all wanted war for a number of reasons. They thought war was going to be going to resolve a lot of social and economic problems. And the great social problem war was supposed to resolve was the threat of revolution and the push towards democratization, which our leaders, being elitists and not in favor of democracy, we disliked very much, but they were particularly concerned about the specter of revolution. It seemed to them, in the years leading up to the 1914, that there was a race between war and revolution, and which would come first. That was a big question. If revolution comes first, it's the end of the civilization as the elites of Europe knew it. If, on the other hand, war would come first, it may put an end to the revolution. So that's really one of the reasons, and it's not the only one, it was an economic reason as well, why the elites of Europe, the French, the British, the Germans, the Russians, all of them really were hoping for a good war to clean the air, and actually a war that would serve as antidote to social revolution. That was really one of the major, major reasons of war. So the fear of social revolution. And also, next to that, economic reasons. But maybe we can talk about that later on.
For sure. You're talking about this war as a sort of like inoculation against these revolution, these social revolutions. Of course, there was the Bolshevik Revolution, which came along very shortly. What was the interplay between World War that war and the rise of the Bolsheviks?
Well, here we are dealing with the dialectic of war and revolution. Some historians prefer to talk about the First World War and stay away from the topic of the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, which was part two of the Russian Revolution, part one being the one in the spring of 1917, the Bolsheviks coming to power in October 1917. The war was intended by the elites, was wanted by the elites of Europe, was in many ways provoked by the elites of Europe, who were hoping that war would serve as an antidote to revolution. But in fact, it's one of the ironies of history that war produced exactly the opposite. Rather than putting an end to this specter of revolution, chasing away once and for all the specter of revolution, as war was supposed to have done, the war actually would end up producing the revolution. And that's a great irony in a sense, but it's understandable if you know what the war actually ended up doing to people, instead of being short and victorious and basically ending up reinforcing the existing social political systems in Germany, Russia, Britain, France, and so on, you know, it basically undermined the loyalty of people to the established order. It undermined their faith in their leaders, in the political, religious leaders, and so on. It did all of that, and as a result of that, eventually it made many, many people, in some countries more, in other countries fewer, basically ready, eager, and willing to overthrow the old system, in other words, make a revolution. And these revolutions actually happened in quite a few countries. We shouldn't forget that. The revolution succeeded in Russia, where the Bolsheviks took control of it. But we should not forget that it was also a big revolution at the end of the war in Germany, which came close to succeeding and was had to be smothered in blood. And very few people realize that even in Great Britain, there was a kind of revolutionary situation at the end of 1918, at the beginning of 1919, with major disturbances and strikes and problems in cities like Liverpool and Glasgow and Belfast, even a mutiny in one of the ships of the Royal Navy and so on. And that problem could only be resolved by bringing in major social and political reforms, like an extension of the suffrage and bringing in the 8-hour workday and so on. These concessions were needed to basically defuse a revolutionary situation. So there is a direct causal relationship between the war, the First World War, and the revolution not only the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, but the revolutions in general and the revolutionary movements. And then the war also caused the reforms, a certain amount of democratization, which also the elites had hoped to stop before the war, by means of war, but which, again, the war forced them to introduce even more democracy than before. The way I see it is that the war, the First World War, was not a war for democracy, as it was called by Wilson. It actually was much more a war against democracy. But, of course, you had to use slogans to sell the war to people. You could hardly tell people that it was a war against, you know, an attempt to give them more power and more input in government. So we had to pretend that it was for democracy. That's not really true. That's how rationalities were invented. It was told that it was the war to end all wars, and that wasn't true. And indeed, I think we also rationalized our entry into the war and our role in the war in many other ways. In the case of Canada, for example, the idea was conjured up that our contribution to the war made Canada really the nation it is today. You know, the idea that on the battlefield of Vimy, Canada was born. And I think this is absolute mythology. I think this is not true. I think a country like Canada did not need a war to be born. I mean, why does there have to be blood involved, really? Many countries have emerged from the scene of history without bloody wars and bloodshed and sacrifices like that. But, of course, that whole story is a way in which even historians, even today, rationalize the slaughter, rationalize the massacre by saying, well, something good came out of it. At least Canada was born on the battlefield. Therefore, the sacrifices were worthwhile. I don't believe that for a minute.
Now, it seems that central to the whole this world war dynamic was this issue of alliances, and you had on the one hand the Allies, which incorporated the United Kingdom, France, and the Russian Empire, and then the Central Powers of Germany and Austria Hungary, and as a result of those alliances, you could have the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria, just triggering this whole domino effect that just spread beyond the region.
Well, I am not a big fan of the kind of theory that the war basically broke out because of the alliances.
Yeah.
It is true that the system of alliances helped or explained the ways in which the war was started. I believe the reason, the root causes for the war, is that the war was wanted by our elites and that they hoped to achieve great things on the social and even economic field. We can talk about economics later, I think we should. But the fact that there were military alliances, which automatically kicked in case of a threat of war, certainly didn't help the cause. It is known that, for example, France and Russia were allies, and that if one was going to be involved in a war against Germany, that the other one was automatically going to take part. There's no doubt about it. But the fact is that the assassination in Sarajevo was used as an opportunity to start a war which people wanted. I don't for a minute believe, and I think it's silly to believe that the assassination of Sarajevo, which by itself was very unimportant, really was the cause of the war. It was simply the pretext which countries that whose leaders wanted to go to war needed to actually go to war. And at that stage, the alliance system kicked in. It is true that having allies, the alliance system also caused our leaders who wanted war to want war sooner rather than later. And let me clarify that with the example of France, for example. France, the leaders of France wanted a war against Germany, if only to get Alsace-Lorraine back, but that was by no means the only reason. And they knew, the leaders of France knew that France alone could never defeat Germany militarily. It was impossible. So France needed help from a big friend. That big friend they found in Russia. Russia, whose military power was highly overestimated before the First World War. So France thought, with Russia on our side, we can beat Germany. Now, in fact, there's no way that we could lose against Germany with the mighty Russians on our side. As I mentioned, they overestimated the power of Russia in 1914, as much as in 1941 the Germans would underestimate the military power of the Soviet Union. So in France then, in 1911, 1912, 1913, and in 1914, they're counting on the big Russian bear to help them kick the butt of the German eagle, so to speak. But there's a big concern here. The alliance between Republican France and authoritarian Tsarist Russia is not a natural alliance. It actually goes against nature. France was the most democratic country in Europe at that time, and Russia the most authoritarian, the most undemocratic. Would that alliance survive the death of the Tsar and the arrival of a new Tsar who might be less Francophile, for example? Big question. Also, might Russia not go through a revolution again as it did in 1905, which might overthrow the Tsarist system, and thereby also basically put an end to the alliance with France, which is exactly what would happen in 1917. The Bolsheviks would come to power and would pull Russia out of the war, causing great problems for France and her allies, because it would allow the Germans to turn an entire army against the Western allies. So the French were concerned that the alliance of Russia might not last forever. Therefore, the French generals, in the months before the First World War, were putting pressure on the political leaders to start this damn war as soon as possible, while we can still count on the Russian bear. Because if, for some reason, the Russian bear ceases to be our ally, we can forget beating Germany in the war. So, therefore, better war sooner rather than later.
There are areas of the world which are very rich in resources, and that we could see these imperial powers, and I know Vladimir Lenin, among others, said that this is essentially a war of imperialism, my paraphrase.
Yes, well, Lenin observed what was happening, and he wrote his famous booklet, A Pamphlet, really, on imperialism in 1916, actually drawing conclusions from what he saw happening in 1914 and the way he understood the war to have the reasons for the war, why it happened. Well, let's talk about countries and territories with resources. It's a fact that up to 1914, there was keen competition between major industrial powers, the ones that would be involved in the war. Great Britain was the greatest industrial power of much of the 19th century. but felt very challenged by the arising star, which was Germany happened to be. France was still an industrial power, but you know, getting less to be less so and fearing the continued growth of Germany. And they were all looking at each other, all wanting to compete. And everybody wanted to sort of have advantages for what they would sometimes is called their national economies. Today, economies are much more intertwined internationally than they were then. 100 years ago, this internationalization had not gone as far yet. And it was believed that every industrial power needed the kind of territories for which they could use as exclusive markets for their products and where they could find cheap raw materials which useful for their industry, such as copper or rubber or whatever, and also cheap labor like the coolies the British used to build railways and do other dirty work and wherever it was needed. And so it was believed that without such territories at your service, you know, to be used exclusively as you saw fit, you know, and to basically get an advantage against the competition, that you wouldn't be able to compete effectively and that you may well fall by the wayside and lose out in this sort of rat race, you might say, among the leading industrial powers, or as Lenin would have put it, imperialist powers. So everybody was looking for, well, usually it was colonies. That was where the good stuff was. You know, even little country like Belgium had the Congo where there was plenty of copper, for example. Well, Germany felt very underprivileged because Germany didn't have rich, important, and big African colonies. They had a piece of the Kalahari Desert and had some of the steppes of the wonderful region of Mount Kilimanjaro, which is great for sightseeing to see animals, but not so wonderful for resources, if you know what I mean. So they all wanted more territories, colonies, and not only colonies, but territories even within Europe. For example, Germany wanted some of the goodies of Eastern Europe. For example, the rich agricultural land of Ukraine there had their eyes on. And that's important because Ukraine, of course, has been in the news a lot recently, and it involves some of the same considerations. You know, who's going to get the benefit of the rich agricultural lands and its products, you know, of the Ukraine? But there were particular reasons, particular products which were very much in demand and which certain imperial powers really wanted to lay their hands on. And I'm thinking here one raw material that was in great demand, became in great demand around 1900, was the oil. Because, for example, the Navy, the British Royal Navy, was switching from firing the ships with the boats with coal to oil. Now, Britain had lots of coal, no problem, but oil, there was no oil in Britain. So Britain had to buy its oil from the United States, which was a rival in the rat race among industrial countries. And then they realized there was oil to be had in Mesopotamia, which was part of the Ottoman Empire. So we have to have the oil of Mesopotamia. That's, by the way, today Iraq. So we have to have it, but and that shouldn't be a problem because the Ottoman Empire was the weak man of Europe, as it was called, not only Europe, but also the Middle East. And it shouldn't be a big deal to grab a piece of territory. We had done it before. Egypt was part of the Ottoman Empire, and Tunisia had been part of the Ottoman Empire, had been pocketed by the French. So why couldn't we grab Mesopotamia? Well, the problem is that the Ottoman Empire is an ally of Germany. And if we were to war against Mesopotamia, you're going to have war against Germany. Well, so be it. In fact, the concern to have oil was very important, was extremely important, especially since the alliance between the Ottoman Empire and Germany and the common project, the Baghdad Railway, a railway from Berlin via Constantinople to Baghdad, opened up the perspective that the oil of Mesopotamia would flow to German ports and basically be used to fuel the German Navy rather than our Navy, and that would be a catastrophe. So it couldn't happen again. Time was seemingly against us. So we had to have that oil badly. And if it meant war against the Ottoman Empire, that's too bad, so sad. And if it means war against Germany, well, damn it, we have to have war against Germany too. And that's why Britain in those years actually approaches France and Russia, mighty partners, who can actually help to defeat Germany on land, while we send our troops from India to land in Basra and take Mesopotamia, which is exactly what happened during the First World War. You know, the British sent only a relatively small army to France and Belgium, but the bulk of their army actually went from India directly to Mesopotamia and fought in the Middle East against the Ottoman Turks. And what happened after victory? Great Britain basically pocketed much of the Middle East, especially the oil-rich regions. And that was a major concern. And that was the reason for approaching France and Russia and becoming allies with them. Because until 1900, France was the enemy, and Russia was an enemy. And actually, Britain had better relations with Germany. So all that changed because of oil. And by the way, not only oil, but rubber was also important. But you don't want to get into too much details here, you could get sidetracked.
Well, okay, Jacques Pauls, what about, like, with the conclusion of the war, there was, of course, as you were pointing to it, like a major shakeup, realignments. I mean, we had the Ottoman Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire is pretty much coming to an end. United States becoming much more robust. What would you say are some of the other major developments coming out of this conflict that's served to shape the direction in which the world has taken?
It depends on what level
politically and economically
analyze the situation. I mean, certainly the map of Europe had changed big time. Some major empires had simply vanished. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was no more, and instead of that, you had a mosaic of little countries like Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and Hungary and little Austria, and they had a new country called Yugoslavia, which has been broken up ever since. So that actually what was once one big part of Central Europe under one umbrella of the Habsburgs, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, today is a mosaic of countries which has caused some problems. The wars in Yugoslavia come to mind, for example. I mean, Bismarck famously said about that, about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that if it didn't exist, somebody would have to invent it. He was joking in a way, but he was a little bit right in that at least it kept these people together, it kept them from flying at each other's throats. Now, whether that would have worked in the long run is a different question, of course. But there are other ways in which the First World War then influenced the 20th century, became the mother of the 20th century. And I think more importantly is to look at it at the social level. I told you at first that, as I see it, that the war was wanted because it was supposed to serve as an antidote to revolution. It was supposed to be a way to stop the democratization in which the elites of Europe had no interest whatsoever. They did not like democracy at all, contrary to what we now sometimes seem to think. And those expected economic advantages. But on the social level, then, they expected the war to chase away once and for all the specter of revolution. It put a stop to this nonsense of a development towards more democracy, the democratization. Oddly enough, what happened is that the war produced the opposite. The war produced a revolution, and that revolution succeeded in Russia. And the war also made it necessary to avoid revolution in countries such as Germany and Belgium and Britain to introduce major democratic reforms, not only political reforms like widening the right to suffrage, the right to vote, to include more of the lower classes, the masses. It also involved social democratization. For example, introduction of the eight-hour day, as opposed to having people work, many more hours than eight in one day, as had been the case in the 20th century. So the elites essentially were very disappointed that the war that they had unleashed in high hopes of gaining from it actually produced losses from their perspective. But it would be nice to think that the elites simply said, okay, well, that's just the way it goes, too bad, so sad. But no, they were not going to put up with that. They were looking out for an opportunity to undo these concessions, to make up for these losses. And that means, first of all, wiping out the revolution, which was now incarnated in the form of the Soviet Union. And secondly, still find a way to roll back the democratization, especially those reforms that were introduced after the war. And that crystallized in movements which we now describe as fascism. Because fascism was a way in which we could annul democracy, essentially, bring in dictators who are going to basically do things we want to do, and above all, a fascist dictator who's going to wipe out the revolution. In this case, the revolution in the form of the Soviet Union. And that, of course, was the German dictator. That was Hitler who was going to do that job. At the same time, the rivalry among the imperial powers still continued. I mean, the war, while it gave advantages to Britain, for example, possession of the oil fields in the Middle East, and it gave great advantages and more leverage to the United States, especially with respect to goings on in Europe, the war did not resolve the issue. The competition remained and became even keener than ever before. The one big loser in the imperial, you might say, the imperialist rat race was Germany. But Germany was still strong enough to remain a major player. And as a result of that, the issue of, you might say, who was going to be number one, who would be the winners in the race among national economies, among industrial powers, that still remained an open question. And in a sense, the Second World War is more of the same as the First World War. You know, the idea was still to settle, you know, the issue as to who would get what in terms of, you know, of areas with resources such as oil and rubber and so forth, and also, you know, what was going to happen, or how could we destroy the revolution, in this case the Soviet Union, and not the Germany, of course. That was the country, the power that was supposed to wipe out the Soviet Union. And when the Nazis actually prepared to invade the Soviet Union, there was a lot of sympathy for their cause in Great Britain and in the United States. You know, you should not underestimate that. Some people were disappointed that Hitler didn't wipe out the Soviet Union, that he failed in his great mission of life to destroy the Soviet Union, which basically the country, the cradle of the revolution.
Okay, just maybe one last question. Here we are 100 years after the start of World War I, and we're still sitting in the shadow of that great conflict. What would you say briefly would be the main aspects of the war that we should learn lessons from in order to that we never again repeat the mistakes of the past?
One obvious lesson, I think, that should be obvious, but somewhere it seems to be one that our leaders never learn, is that wars, that people can expect wonderful things of wars, but that it never works out, that they never work out the way they're supposed to. You know, that your plans never work perfectly, and the objectives you hope to achieve somehow are never achieved. I'm thinking of the First World War, the great plans of the Germans, the Schlieffen Plan. You could throw that in the paper basket after a few months. Then the French plans were already thrown in the basket earlier, the paper basket earlier. But not only that, the idea that the elites had, and they were convinced that a war would solve their problems. By the way, these ideas they got from intellectuals of that time, like Nietzsche, for example, and the social Darwinists, you know, who thought war was a wonderful remedy for social problems. You know, and that didn't work out. Instead of preventing the revolution, it produced a revolution. Instead of enabling them to put an end to democratization, it forced them to introduce even more democratic reforms after the war. So one of the lessons should be that war is going to give you nasty surprises. It's not going to work out the way you think. And we hear a recent example of that is George Bush's war, when he sent the Marines into Saddam Hussein's Iraq in 2003, and after a few weeks, proudly proclaimed victory. Well, it's now more than 10 years later, and we're still fighting in Iraq, and there's no end to the misery. And even though Bush thought he had basically achieved the wonderful thing, and from now on there would be peace in the Middle East and democracy and all that, and none of that happened, in fact. I would argue that the situation in the Middle East today is far worse than it was in 2003, when Saddam Hussein was still ruling Iraq, and when Gaddafi was still ruling Libya, which is North Africa, the Middle East, but you get the point. So that the wars hold massive surprises for people who think they can benefit from it. And oddly enough, it's also true that the problems in the Middle East, of course, we can trace back right to the First World War, when the Ottoman Empire was broken up. As the Austro-Hungarian Empire was broken up, and there emerged a mosaic of countries, mostly controlled by Western powers such as Britain and France. France controlled Syria and Lebanon, and Britain controlled Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Kuwait and Palestine, later on to become Israel. And we know what kind of problems all that led to. You, in a way, you could have said, Bismarck could have said the same thing by the Ottoman Empire that is said about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, that if it didn't exist, one should have invented it. I mean, I have no sympathy for the Ottomans. I think it was an obsolete kind of system, and certainly far cry from the democracy, which we'd all like to see. But you didn't have those terrible wars and terrible things that are happening in the Middle East now under the Ottomans. Mm. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways in which we can now look at what's going on in the world and understand it better by seeking to understand the First World War.
Jacques Pauwels, thank you very much for sharing your perspectives on this conflict with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jacques Pauwels is a Belgian-born Canadian historian and author of the 2000 book, The Myth of the Good War, America in the Second World War. He has a French-language book on the World War I available now. An English version will be available in 2015. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.